So much for no jail time. Kathleen Kane is heading behind bars. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Today, the former Pennsylvania Attorney General was sentenced to 10 to 23 months in jail, followed by 8 years of probation. This after being convicted of perjury earlier this year. WHYY's Katie Culinary has more on the downfall of the state's one-time top prosecutor.
Once seen as a Democratic rising star, Kathleen Kane resigned as Pennsylvania Attorney General in mid-August, just 2 days after a jury convicted her of perjury and abuse of office. Kane was found guilty of orchestrating a plot to leak secret investigative material to smear a political enemy and later lying about it under oath. As news helicopters swarmed overhead, Bucks County Prosecutor Michelle Henry told reporters what Kane did was a disgrace.
She put her own desire for personal revenge above everything else, above the citizens of this state, above the hardworking prosecutors and the staff of the Attorney General's office. Everybody deserved better.
Before she was led out of the courtroom in handcuffs, Kane hugged her 15-year-old son, who had testified on her behalf earlier in the day. Kane also tearfully pleaded for leniency for the sake of her two sons. But while Common Pleas Judge Wendy Demchik Aloy acknowledged the pain her children would feel, she put the blame for that on Kane, saying, quote, "That's a decision you made, not this court." The judge also admonished Kane for being a politician consumed by her image who exploited her position as state attorney general to battle perceived enemies. Kane's attorneys declined to comment after the sentencing, but have previously vowed to appeal. She'll be held at the Montgomery County Correctional Facility in Eagleville until she posts $75,000 cash bail. Once paid, Kane will be free while she appeals her conviction. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
The former aide to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who said time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, said today that she was left out to dry by the administration. From WHYY's New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez reports that Bridget Ann Kelly says she told top officials about the lane closures of the George Washington Bridge, and they denied it.
Kelly says she told Governor Christie and other top officials on several occasions about what she thought was a legitimate traffic study that closed lanes leading to the George Washington Bridge. Even after she reminded them that she discussed the lane closures, Kelly says Christie and others still denied it. Christie still maintains he never heard of the closures until much later. Kelly says back then she felt alone and that, quote, "it was like an alternate world. None of it was making sense." Kelly is talking about the closures for the first time since they occurred in 2013, as she testifies in federal court in Newark. She's one of two defendants facing conspiracy, wire fraud, and civil rights charges. She says former Port Authority official David Wildstein told her the lane closures at the bridge were part of a legitimate traffic study, but prosecutors say Kelly and co-defendant Bill Baroni caused traffic jams in Fort Lee to punish Democratic Mayor Mark Sokolich for not endorsing Christie for re-election. Wildstein pleaded guilty and has been the prosecution's star witness. Kelly also explained some seemingly incriminating text messages that appeared to show she was happy during the 4 days of traffic jams. In one, she testified she told Wildstein that she was smiling not because of the traffic, but because he told her the study was going well. In another, she texted, quote, "I feel badly about the kids, I guess." She said she actually did feel badly about school buses stuck in gridlock, saying, quote, "I'm a mother, I have four kids. That really upset me. That bothered me." Kelly is back on the stand for more questions from prosecutors tomorrow. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Most Garden State voters in the latest Fairleigh Dickinson study find most supported an amendment requiring all revenue from the state's newly raised gas tax to be dedicated to New Jersey's Transportation Trust Fund. Poll director Krista Jenkins says 46% of registered voters surveyed support the amendment, 39% oppose it.
There's been so much talk about gas tax increases that it very well could be that this is one of those issues that's proving a little too complex. And so what we're seeing here are people who may not be entirely aware of what that amendment would do.
Another ballot question allowing for the expansion of casino gambling to northern parts of New Jersey is opposed by 70% of voters surveyed. Only 24% support it. On those days when another helping of Sloppy Joe doesn't seem appetizing or prudent, school kids have always had an escape: the school vending machine. But in Philadelphia, this humble dispenser of snacks and sodas has been bleeding money and popularity, and that says something about the eating habits of today's students. But what exactly does it say? WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
It's lunchtime at Frankfort High School in northeast Philadelphia, and the cafeteria is teeming with hungry teenagers. But I'm all alone, standing in front of the school's snack machine.
Let's see, what do I want here? Cheddar fries, toasted chips, small bag of burritos.
Like generations of high schoolers before me, I slide a few coins in the slot, make my alphanumeric selection, and wait for a bag of something called Ritz Toasted Chips to tumble out. The crackers aren't bad. I'm a sucker for sour cream and onion. But the simple fact that I could stand there during the lunch rush for 3 minutes and mull over my choices should tell you something. It should tell you school vending machines just aren't very popular anymore.
I would say that in this era of nutritional standards, vendors are facing lots of challenges.
Emily Reformat is the editor of Automatic Merchandiser, a trade publication for the vending machine industry. About a decade ago, districts and states started limiting the types of sugary drinks and salty snacks schools could put in vending machines. In 2013, the federal government rolled out healthy snack guidelines for all of the nation's school vending machines. The changes haven't killed the industry, says Reformat.
But it is in a transition. Already, big bottlers, often we associate them with soda, have been pulling out of school accounts because the accounts are less profitable.
And it's less profitable for school districts, too. A decade ago, the School District of Philadelphia made about $500,000 annually off its school vending machines. Last year, that number was a paltry $43,000. Now, that seems like a bad thing, right? As soon as you replace Lay's potato chips with baked Lay's, kids bail. But, says Juliana Cohen, a researcher at Merrimack College and the Harvard School of Public Health,
what we're finding is that simultaneously, when they're not buying these snack foods, we're actually finding increases in purchases of the school meals.
And that's potentially a very good thing. It means kids are eating less filler and more actual meals.
Now, we're giving them options, but all the options are healthy.
In the fight against childhood obesity, schools have always been a beachhead for public health warriors. It's a closed environment, this place where policymakers can largely control what's served. Plus, Cohen points out, the habits kids pick up in school can influence how they behave outside it.
And we know from research that it often takes children 12 or more exposures to a new food before they start to like it. And so this is an opportunity for them to be exposed to these new foods and potentially learn to like these new foods so that when they're outside of school, they may be requesting those foods as well.
Now, everything isn't perfect. The new snack standards still allow for lots of salty snacks and even ice cream bars. Though I wasn't permitted to interview kids at Frankfort High, a couple I spoke with off mic said the ice cream products were still the most popular. But overall, there are some positive public health takeaways here. Philadelphia's rapid decline in vending machine revenue could be proof that policymakers have finally created a food ecosystem where kids almost have to eat healthy. Now, that's not much solace for the people who supply and install snack dispensers, and it makes you wonder, is this the end of the line for the once ubiquitous school vending machine?
It's an interesting question.
Emily Reformat thinks the school vending machine industry will have to evolve, but it will survive. In part, she thinks that's because of the healthier habits kids are starting to form.
Part of the answer to keeping school vending will be a new generation of students who grow up with these required items in the vending machine as the only items. They never had access to different items and they don't know any better.
And so perhaps the old reliable snack machine will trudge on, even if it looks a little different than it did before. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
This evening's forecast, mostly clear skies, falling back to 40 degrees overnight. Tomorrow, sunny, high 55. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. The universe is more crowded with stuff than astronomers previously thought. Let's concentrate on the clutter with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, a galaxy is a fairly big entity, and now we have to rethink how many galaxies there are in our universe.
The results that we're talking about here, Dave, actually come due to the kind of examination of the Hubble Deep Field photographs that were originally taken in 1995 and other photographs and surveys from other instruments since then. And as it turns out, mathematical analysis leads us to conclude that what we've seen so far is really only one-tenth of the number of galaxies that the universe probably holds. So if we look at what we estimate is the current number of known galaxies at 100 billion, then the number that's actually being considered for galaxies in the universe is 1 trillion.
How many stars on average in an average-sized galaxy?
Well, let's say 300 billion stars per galaxy. No, I'm not going to tell you how many stars that would be in the universe.
Or how many planets might be orbiting those stars.
If the assumptions that the Kepler spacecraft is giving us are anywhere near correct, it seems likely that every star has at least one planet, then that severely inflates the number of planets throughout the universe into a number we can hardly even consider saying.
Also inflating the number of planets that are potentially in the Goldilocks zone orbiting their star.
It's probably safe, although not scientific, it's probably safe to say that we could take 1/100th the number of planets in the known universe currently, 1/100th, and we'd still come out with billions of planets located in what's considered a Goldilocks zone, that region around the star where water can exist as a liquid on that planet's surface.
We've learned in conversation that most of the stuff of the universe, though, is dark matter. Does this change that ratio with this newfound estimate that there are 10 times as many galaxies as previously thought?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that yet. There's still a lot more analysis that has to be done. But one of the things we have to think about is that there is a lot more of the universe beyond what we know of as the observable universe. So we're talking about an age that's much older than what we have been able to observe into before. And we're also considering that the continued expansion of the universe beyond what we're capable of seeing is a volume in which there are far more galaxies. Now, are we talking about very, very young galaxies in the very early universe? Or are we talking about larger galaxies? Or are we talking about smaller galaxies that eventually combine to become larger galaxies that we know of? It's almost as if we're saying, Dave, that we're beginning to understand that the observations we've been making have only been in this volume of one-tenth of the known universe.
A bit of a refresher. Is it still one of the immutable tenets that matter is neither created nor destroyed?
Yeah, the laws have not changed. The rules haven't changed.
So all that stuff, newly discovered, yet to be discovered, all existed in that first moment, the Big Bang?
Well, that's the idea, is that it all existed back then when all of the forces that we know of were all tied into one unified force at the very beginning of the universe.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place.
And finally, professional performers at stage productions in the Philadelphia area will be honored this evening at the 2016 Barrymore Awards. The awards, held at the Merriam Theater in Philadelphia, honor the best theater productions in the region. Categories include Best Play, Best Musical, Best Director, along with Best Actor and Actress categories and Behind the Scenes honors. In all, 41 productions were nominated. One company in particular, Philadelphia's Theater Exile, is poised for a big night with a ceremony-high 10 nominations for its production of The Invisible Hand. You can follow NewsWorks blogger Howard Shapiro on Twitter this evening as he live blogs the event. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Since 1991, school districts in Pennsylvania obtain funding based on a lot of factors, but not student enrollment fluctuations. A quarter of a century on, That rule is putting the hurt on some schools and their students. We'll hear more about that on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.